Welcome once again to our program, The Universal Call to Holiness, Our Wholeness, or the call of all to be a faithful follower in the footsteps of Jesus. This universal call to holiness came from the Vatican Council document, 1962 to 65. The Vatican Council brought all the bishops of the Catholic world together in Rome at the Vatican, and continually repeated by Pope John Paul II the Great, as he spoke around the world, east, west, north, and south, to so many countries in his being the pilgrimaging Pope of the Catholic Church. My guest again today is Ron Eldred, who is Professor of World History at John Paul II Catholic High, and also a religion. And he's also obviously a very fine student of the Catechism of the Catholic Church, at the papal encyclicals, and some of the great doctors of the Church, like John of the Cross, Teresa of Avila, Teresa of Lisieux. So welcome once again, Ron, to our program. I'm your host, Monsignor Larry Moran, Pastor Emeritus at St. Patrick Catholic Church at 19th and Poplar. Ron, we've been talking about the call to holiness, and for each person, whatever state of life, and then we talked about the means of holiness, the three great theological virtues, faith, hope, love. We talked about the four cardinal are the hinge virtues, prudence, justice, temperance, and fortitude. Then we talked about the fruits of the Spirit. We give the seven gifts of the Spirit, along with the seven sacraments. We said that seven keeps popping up, almost like a mystical number, in the important sacred teachings of the Church. We talked about the seven gifts of the Holy Spirit, and we talked about the fruits of the Spirit. The nine are even more commonly perhaps called 12 fruits of the Spirit, nine being given us by St. Paul. And then we come up now to the Beatitudes, or the eight Beatitudes, which are sort of the summary of Jesus' life, summary of Jesus' preaching, and as you said so well before, is his practice. So I think most all of us have heard something about the Sermon on the Mount, in which the Beatitudes are the beginning. So if we could go ahead and talk about how the eight Beatitudes are the guidelines, the blueprint that Jesus himself gave us to climb the hill of holiness, or to climb the hill of Mount Carmel, as John of the Cross calls it, and Teresa also. So let's talk about the eight Beatitudes.
All right. Let me remind our listeners before I start directly answering that question, is that what we've been doing with this whole series is how to become holy, how to become like Jesus so that we can get to heaven. And the Beatitudes are the prelude to Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, found in Matthew chapters 5 through 7, which I've always looked upon as sort of like the blueprint for being holy and getting to heaven.
Well, now, pardon me, when you say the prelude to the Sermon on the Mount, isn't it considered part of the Sermon on the Mount?
It's certainly a part of it.
Okay, it says the beginning.
It's the beginning, sort of an introduction to it, I guess.
Fine.
This sermon was given, from what I've been able to put together, at the beginning of his, pretty close to the beginning of his public ministry in Galilee. Probably given on a small mountain, when we say the Mount, the Sermon on the Mount, nearby the Sea of Galilee, or the Lake Tiberias, as it was called by the Romans. It has some other names. I think the Lake Genethoret.
Lake Genezareth. That's in Hebrew, means harp, because it's shaped like a harp.
In this sermon, Jesus made specific promises of beatitude, or happiness, to those who perform certain good works. And as I suggested just a minute ago, beatitude means happiness, blessedness, bliss, or blissfulness, things of that sort. Father John Hardin, whom we have looked at quite a bit here in our series, because he was one of the world's greatest catechists until his death, I believe, in about 2004. He defines the Beatitudes as, quote, a summary of the difficulties to be overcome by the faithful Christian, end of quote. He says that they are significant because they are uniquely Christian principles of human conduct. And he goes on to say, the norms set down in the Beatitudes go far beyond the dialogue in which Christ confirmed the Decalogue, that is, the Ten Commandments. A deca means it comes from ten, log comes from the idea of law, so actually it's, word, or logos, I believe, in Greek. So it'd be the ten words, literally what Decalogue means, or the Ten Commandments. And the Beatitudes are the fulfillment of the Decalogue, really. The Ten Commandments given on Mount Sinai summarize pre-Christian morality.
All right, before the coming of Christ, yes. and the New Testament.
And on the other hand, the Beatitudes assume the Decalogue. They assume the Decalogue, and then they go beyond it. And one reason the Beatitudes are able, humanly speaking, to make such heavy demands on human nature is because God, when he became man, gave man the grace to go beyond the Decalogue.
So I think that's important you say that, because they certainly go beyond the Ten Commandments.
Yes. Yeah, Jesus said, you know, I came to fulfill the law. In other words, or not to abrogate the law, but at the same time, he goes far beyond that.
And we'll talk about that.
Yes, we'll talk about the reasons for that and how that was, you know, why that was possible for people after his resurrection and ascension into heaven and all that type of thing to do. But the Beatitudes are a perfect synthesis of Christ's own life. They are, if you wish, a summary of Christ's own practice of virtue. And when we say that perfection consists in following Christ and ask what that means, we can answer that it means practicing the Beatitudes, which Christ first practiced and then preached, as Father Hardin tells us.
I like those that nice sounding there, practicing the Beatitudes, which first Jesus practiced and preached, got a rhythm to it. But as we've said so often in this series, we don't have to know necessarily all these individual names of the fruits of the Spirit and the gifts of the Spirit, although it's helpful to, but we just have to keep our eyes fixed on Jesus, because he is the way and the truth and the life.
Well, I think if a person does, he will do these things.
And certainly that's we learn it by following the footsteps of our Lord. Well, as you said earlier, and I think it's important, Jesus said he did not come to destroy the law of Moses or the Ten Commandments given on Mount Sinai and what the prophets taught, but to fulfill them. So let's speak about that a little bit.
According to Father Hardin, to make the connection between the Old and the New Testaments, St. Matthew went to great pains to recall the Sermon on the Mount with its studied contrast with the ethics of the Old Law. I'm quoting Father Hardin here, or at least of most Jews at the time of Christ. Jesus began by insisting that he did not come to destroy the law of the prophets, but to fulfill them. Then he proceeded to lay down a standard of morality that marked for all time the cleavage from former days and the fulfillment of a long-awaited Holy One who would sanctify those who believed in his name. Then he goes on to say, writing for the Jews, Matthew synthesized the Master's teachings in the eight Beatitudes and climaxed them in the Lord's Prayer. As you might recall, that was one of the times we find the Lord's Prayer in the Gospels, in the four Gospels. Taken together, these norms of conduct introduced a new dimension into human culture, and quite alone warrant the conclusion that Jesus of Nazareth professed to be more than a human legislator, end of quote.
Now, you might just say a word about that, because we have many ways we come to conclusion that Jesus is more than God, but you're specifying one there that he had to be more than a human legislator. Why did Father Hardin say that? what makes him say that? Because of the perfection and the balance and the insight of Jesus' teachings?
Well, although Jesus went beyond the Ten Commandments, as Father Hardin says, Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount that he came not to abolish the law and the prophets, but to fulfill them. We find this in Matthew 5:17. And in this regard, he said, now we're talking about Jesus, quoting Jesus, quote, "For truly I say to you, till heaven and earth pass away, not an iota, not a dot, will pass from the law until all is accomplished. Whoever then relaxes one of the least of these commandments and teaches men to do so shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But he who does them and teaches them shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven." The word iota, of course, is a Greek letter. It's the seventh letter of the Greek alphabet. And the reason that we use it for something little tiny, a little bit, because it's the smallest letter. It's the tiniest letter in the Greek alphabet. So yeah, over the centuries, it's when we refer to iota, or iota, I think would be the Greek way of pronouncing it, we just simply mean something, you know, very small, a small bit, something very tiny. What Jesus did in the Sermon on the Mount was to emphasize and elaborate on the commandments of love found in the Mosaic Law, that is, the Ten Commandments, the love of God and neighbor. We talk about the two great commandments of love, and by these, the first three commandments, if you people would remember, are involved with loving God, and then the second seven commandments deal with the loving of our neighbor.
So we have the Ten Commandments that came from Moses on Mount Sinai, two tablets, three with the ones that pertain to God, seven that pertain to, on the other tablet, pertain to our neighbor. And then, of course, we had Jesus summarizing from the Old Testament the two great laws, the most important, love God, love your neighbor as you love yourself. So all that came out of the Old Testament.
Yes, and we can give some examples here how Jesus went beyond the Old Testament, the commands of the Old Testament. Father Hardin has a wonderful little quote here. I'll read part of it. Quote, in this regard, quote, "The logic behind this conclusion is clear. Jesus explicitly raised the demands of the Mosaic Law, known to have been given by Yahweh," that is the Jewish name for God. "He thereby equated himself with the Lord of the Old Testament, because in his own name, and without apology, he proclaimed such drastic revisions of Judaic morality that even after 20 centuries, the Jewish code does not recognize the change. That is, in the dissolubility of marriage and the right to marriage after divorce. Moreover, Jesus explained the law by adding to it such as saying, quote, 'You have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you, that everyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart.'" This is found in Matthew 5:27-28. Or, give another example. Quote, this is Jesus speaking now. "You have heard that it was said to the men of old, you shall not kill, and whoever kills shall be liable to judgment. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother shall be liable to judgment." This is from Matthew 21:22, from, again, the Sermon on the Mount. Or let's give another one here. Quote, "You have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you." This is Matthew 5:43-44. And one of the reasons the Jews accused Jesus of blasphemy was his appearing to change or add to the law. There were three or four reasons, but that was, well, probably one of the main reasons. Another was he forgave sins, and that was something, again, only God could do, just like only God can change the law. And so
we're saying that as Jesus deals with the old law in the Old Testament, which was good in itself, but then he began to, like on the foundation, build another a floor, or second floor, or third floor in the building. So the foundation was needed and stayed, but he went beyond that. And these wonderful examples you've just given. So Jesus really moved the sinfulness back not just from an action, but actually in through the decision to do an action. And I think it's important to say that, because a person could have an adulterous thought, a person could have a murderous thought, a person could have a hateful thought, but not give in to it, could resist it, and that would be overcoming temptation.
There's an old saying, I'm not sure if it goes back to the Old Testament, but so thinketh a person, so is he.
Well, as a person thinks, so is he. So he is. Yeah. So we're back into, we have to protect even our mind from willingly. And I say that cautiously, because a lot of good Catholics, I think, got to think at one time that, well, if a thought just comes into my mind, adulterous thought or hateful thought or even a murderous thought, that I'm guilty of that. And I'm not guilty until I say, oh, I'm thinking about something I shouldn't be thinking about. I've got to change the channel. I've got to get my mind on something else. Because otherwise, see, the great Teresa of Avila, whom you quote a lot, Ron, a great doctor of the church, said, let no one say, I have acquired a virtue until I have been tempted to the opposite vice. Now, I think that's a classic statement, that I don't have the virtue of sobriety unless I've been tempted to get drunk on New Year's. Some people have a great temptation. Some people don't bother them at all. Some people don't get angry very easily. But if I get angry and tends to blow out the light of my mind, okay, then I'm being tempted to give in to unjust anger, and then I am committing sin. But if I've never been tempted to anger, then I really don't have the virtue, the power of self-control. So I think she made a very important distinction for us there.
Yeah, you were referring to Big Teresa. I know you used to use that distinction between her and Little Teresa, Therese of Lisieux, and you're with the kids over in St. Patrick's and on their feast day when you would have a sermon about each of the two. A little story about Little Teresa or Therese of Lisieux. She was the head of the novices for some time there, several years when she was in the convent there. She died when she was 24, so obviously she had to be pretty young, probably in her early 20s, when she was the head of these novices, and she would give them some spiritual advisement. Of course, you know, she's been made a doctor for that very reason by Pope John Paul II. Because of her spiritual advice and the few writings that she wrote, particularly her autobiography. But she would tell these young nuns, they would come to her and say that I've done certain thing, and she would distinguish. She would help them discern whether or not it really was a sin. And sometimes they would be weighted down, you know, that they'd had a thought, like you were saying a while ago. She said, that's not a sin. You know, she said that the thought, and you fought it, you know, you used God's grace to overcome it, so you didn't really commit a sin. In that case, if a person gets weighted down with that type of thing, then we would call this, I guess, scrupulosity, which is actually a moral sickness, a spiritual sickness.
Spiritual sickness. It can be very, very painful. Well, you know, there's another famous Catholic story about we can, and it's helpful, at least to me, in guiding people. We cannot prevent birds from flying over our head, but we can prevent them from roosting in our hair, which means that temptation can fly through our mind, but as long as we don't let it roost in our mind or roost in our hair, then it's really overcoming temptation, and it's an act of virtue. It's an act of...
Well, that's one of the reasons God allows us to be tempted, so that we can learn to exercise, to practice virtue, to grow in virtue.
One of the ways we grow.
Yes.
All right. Well, we talked a little bit about how the Beatitudes were Jesus fulfilling the Ten Commandments. It seems like he set an awfully high standard by these eight Beatitudes we're going to talk about individually. They go quite far beyond the Ten Commandments and the teachings of the prophets, as great as that is. So how can we explain that?
Well, on this matter, Father Hardin, I think, has a good answer. He says, quote, proclaiming a higher standard of conduct would have been meaningless unless those whom it was intended was assured the moral strength that carried into effect. At this point, all of Christ's references to himself as the source of grace, moral power, come into play. Synthesizing the declaration, this is Jesus speaking, now he's quoting Jesus. Come to me, all you who have labor and are overburdened, and I will give you rest. Shoulder my yoke and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble of heart, and you will find rest for your souls. Yes, my yoke is easy, and my burden is light. End of quote. We find this in Matthew 11, 28 through 30. In other words, humans can achieve the higher standard only with the help of God's grace. The source, of course, is in the sacraments primarily and through prayer.
Let me just tell you a little story about my yoke is easy and my burden is light. There was a group of Quakers in Richmond, which is called the Vatican, Quaker Vatican, because it's the headquarters of all Quakers in the United States. And they have a wonderful college there, Earlham College. But they used to have a group there called Yoke Fellow, and the people would wear on their lapel a little yoke. Like you put two oxen together and that big wooden beam across them. But it was based on what Jesus said there. Take my yoke, join me, put your head into the noose. I'll be on one side, you'll be on the other, and we'll pull the plow together. So Jesus who made yokes as a carpenter, along with St. Joseph, that was a common saying in Jesus' time. So it was saying, I'll be with you. I'm going to help you pull the plow. I'm going to help you do what you need to do. So I just wanted to comment on how beautiful an image Jesus, one of the beautiful images Jesus continually uses, and that he's going to help us. And that's why the eight Beatitudes won't be impossible.
I might add that one of the reasons that God didn't hold the Israelites to as high a standard as those under the new covenant, the new and everlasting covenant, the New Testament, was because they didn't have the sacraments. Father Hardin goes on to say, quote, Christ made his moral doctrine not only possible, but in many ways prescriptive. He means by that, of course, required. He therefore not only describes what his followers might aspire to, but also legislated what they were obliged to do. His parting words to the disciples were that they might teach all that I have commanded you. And his sanction was that those who would believe and act accordingly would be saved. But those who should refuse to believe or refuse to live up to their faith would be lost. And I might add that the old law didn't confer grace either. Grace was obtained by the Israelites by faith in the Messiah, the Christ, the Christos, fulfilled in Jesus Christ. And in other words, when the Jews sacrificed, which they sacrificed animals to renew their covenant, and for other reasons, for their sins, for vast favors and various kinds of things in the temple. My understanding is that these were not grace-giving kinds of things like our sacrifice of the masses, of course, and our other sacraments. So it wasn't really until after Christ came into the world and under the new and everlasting covenant, under the New Testament, that grace is something that God showers on people who ask for it, and it helps them, of course, to live lives in accordance with holy lives and to be like Jesus.
Okay, so we're talking about the great teachings of Jesus, the blueprint he gave us to build on the Ten Commandments, the Eight Beatitudes. Now, the Eight Beatitudes, many people rightly say, are paradoxical in their teaching. So we better talk about what is a paradox, because it seems to be a contradiction.
Yes. The dictionary defines a paradox as, quote, a seemingly contradictory statement that may nonetheless be true. Father Hardin has a nice treatment of this, I think. He says that we speak of Christian mysteries, and so they are. They are not fully comprehensible to the human mind. We are told that he that loses his life will find it, and those who are great will become small, will inherit the kingdom. We are told that God has chosen the little things, the foolish things, to confound the strong and the wise. These are all paradoxes. But then he goes on to ask the question, well, what is a paradox? Well, it's an apparent contradiction. And he states that He likes to identify mystery with paradox and says that our faith is full of paradoxes. He says that in the Beatitudes, the paradox is happiness, which Christ promises is if a person does certain things that naturally or humanly speaking are the very opposite of what we would expect to bring happiness. In other words, in short, he tells us that to do things that we don't naturally enjoy, and then tells us we are going to have a joy from doing them.
Okay, so that's a good explanation from Father Hardin. If I'm going to keep my life, I have to lose it, spiritually taking. Jesus says, if you would keep your life, then lose it in following me.
Well, he goes on to remind us that the Beatitudes are a perfect synthesis of Christ's own life. They are, in a sense, a summary of Christ's own practice of virtue. And so that when we say that perfection consists in following Christ and ask what that means, we can answer that it means practicing the Beatitudes, which Christ first practiced and then preached. This is why I said at the beginning of our little discussion here that, and I tell my students this over the years as well, is that the Beatitudes is sort of like a blueprint for being holy and, being like Jesus and, obviously getting to heaven.
Well, anything else? Our time is starting to run out. Anything else you'd like to say about Beatitudes?
There's a famous theologian, his name is Germain Grisez, that I'm, and I know you and I were talking about him the other day, probably the top moral theologian in the world today, at least certainly one of the very tops. And let me give a little quick quote here. I think we have enough time to squeeze it in here. Along the obvious differences, there also are similarities between the role of the Ten Commandments in the Old Testament and the Beatitudes in the New. As God gives the Ten Commandments to Moses and then to the rest of the law is unfolded from them, so Jesus gives the Beatitudes to his followers. And the rest of the moral implications of the New Covenant are unfolded. The Beatitudes provide a properly Christian moral framework, although their relationship to the rest of the moral content of faith has never been clarified in detail. They have had an important place in moral instruction throughout Christian history. They are extrinsic, but not insignificant, reasons for taking the Beatitudes as organizing principles in analyzing Christian norms and values. And as I said a while ago, I've always told my students that the Sermon on the Mount, which begins with the Beatitudes, is God's blueprint for living virtuous and holy lives.
Okay, so we're coming to the conclusion of the program. We've been talking about the Sermon on the Mount, the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount, in which Jesus gave us these eight instructions, this blueprint for Christian or Christ-like living, and that they are paradoxes. They seem to be contradictions, but they make us think, obviously. If you're going to lose your life for my sake, then you will find it, such those beautiful things that Jesus said. So I think our next program then we'll try to take up actually what are the eight Beatitudes and take them one by one. Probably if anything is known about Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, most of us one way or another have heard something about the Beatitudes. So what the Ten Commandments were from Mount Sinai, the Beatitudes are from the Sermon on the Mount from Jesus, who is the new Moses. Well, may God bless you always and in always.